for those that don't have it, is we've asked the department to come in, bring the committee up to speed with the events that took place some time ago, 2003 or 2002, I think, but were highlighted in the media 2 or 3 months ago around a detainee, female, that was detained in a man or in a male's cell. We'd ask the committee just, I mean the department just to brief us on that one. We also then will move on to and be joined by the Department of Health and the Portfolio Committee or delegates of the Portfolio Committee on Health for us to deal with health-related matters within the department. So that is our program for those that do not have the agenda before them. And also to say to members that at our very next meeting, which is scheduled for the 5th of May, we have been directed to come up to speed with minutes that might not have been approved to date. And we've got 3 sets of minutes, so on the 5th of May, we'll spend the first hour doing in-house business before we move on to meeting with the minister and the department. So that is the business for the next 2 weeks. No, not the next 2 weeks, the next 2 meetings. Right now, welcome the department, and we would hand over to the department to brief us on the matters of Amaravithi Wilson.
Chairperson, thank you, and good morning to the members of the Portfolio Committee as well. To deal with the first issue, I want very briefly to speak on the particular case of Ms. Wilson, but then to in fact take you through a presentation on our admission processes, because I think that the question that that particular case has raised for all of us is, are our admission processes sufficiently tight to ensure that we are able to handle admissions appropriately? In relation to the particular case concerned, this is a case that relates to the period November to April 2002, November 2002 to April 2003, when it was identified that indeed there was a woman in Durban Medium A, a full investigation was done. The issue, just to explain to people, has resurfaced in November last year. It was an issue that was covered in the media at the time. It is an issue that resurfaced in the latter part of last year because she had initiated a civil claim process against the department that was then struck off the roll in November because of the time frames that it had been left hanging without any substantiation coming forward. So it was taken off the roll at that point, and that is what then resurfaced the issue in the media. Our reason for simply indicating this and not going into the details of it is that it is on the roll at Magistrates Court level for the 12th of May. So we would prefer that we do not deal with the specifics of that case because it is subject to a court process in May. What our focus will then be is on dealing with the admission processes so that we've got a sense between us and the Portfolio Committee as to whether the systems that are in place are adequate to be able to address it. I think as we go through this, we need to be vigilant to be focused on the one hand, what are our admission procedures? Are they adequate? The second element, obviously, is do our staff implement those procedures in the way that they should be implemented? The third is, are there sufficient checks and balances in place? Where a mistake or an error takes place, an error either through human error or a deliberate, I suppose it can't be called an error if it's deliberate, but a deliberate erroneous admission takes place, are there sufficient checks and balances for us to be able to pick up on that? And I hope as I talk through the presentation, that sense will be able to come through. I hope that people have got hard copies in front of them because the screen behind is shaking and it's a bit difficult on the eyes. The slide that is slide five basically outlines the various different aspects regarding admission. Some of which I'm not going to go into in that much detail because they're not directly relevant to the question of the identity and hence the correct accommodation of an inmate. But we have thought that it was important to just flag the process because some of the checks and balances lie in other elements of the admission process. Let me move then to the next slide. That basically just gives you a list of the elements of the policy of the B order that addresses the various different aspects. There's an element that we need to look at before we get to the identification process because it must be borne in mind that the admission process, in fact, starts from court. A person is admitted to our centres whether as a remand detainee or as a sentenced inmate on the basis of a warrant. That warrant specifies the exact correctional centre that the person is meant to be detained in, as well as the details of their arrest and their status. It is a fundamentally important element of the basis of all of our systems, and it's something, again, when we speak later on health, you'll see that there are elements of information that it would be valuable if we could have pulled into the warrant that would enable our processes. So the accuracy of that warrant is a critical part, and that relates to, obviously, Department of Justice processes and the SAPS processes and ensuring that the information that we get on that warrant is indeed correct. The person is then transported by the South African Police Service, and they issue a body receipt, which has a SAPS number, SAPS 216 form. That is a list of all of the people that are being. So there's a warrant that is specific to me, Jenny. But there's a body receipt that is all of the people that SAPS is bringing to that correctional centre. Obviously, those two need to correlate. So if there isn't a correlation between those, immediately there's a problem that needs to be picked up on. And this is where the vigilance of personnel comes in. And it's a vigilance that needs to start from the point of issuing that warrant, issuing that body receipt, and going right the way through. Because if everybody in the chain is doing their job correctly, we should be able to pick up on any problem as we go through. So a body receipt says the police officer is bringing 10 people to Polsmore female and the 10 people are the following 10 people. There should be attached to it the 10 warrants. Those warrants should all say these are people going into Polsmore female. If there's any anomaly there, the process stops and the process then is to contact the originator of those documents and be able to verify it. And that is the kind of vigilance that we're expecting from any of the personnel, both in all three of those departments that are involved in those processes. So that is the starting point, in fact, is with that body receipt, because that is what enables us to be confident that SAPS is bringing us the right number of people. That body receipt gets checked while the police are still at our facility. So before the police leave, there has been confirmation, sign-off, by our official as well as by the police. A copy remains with us, a copy goes back to them to say 10 people indeed were delivered, the warrants are all in order. The identification process then deals with identifying that particular person. And again, it's identifying that person against the warrant, but it's also identifying that person in terms of any future identification processes in the department. That's where the name of the person is taken down, that's where the thumbprint is taken down. Obviously, as we move to the electronic identification processes, one will then have photographs in some of our facilities. We already have that. Electronic thumbprints instead of manual thumbprints, and that improves then the identification process. One of the elements of the remand detention remind the TAMI and offender management system, RDOMS process that we are developing at the moment, the information system that we're developing to replace the ANR, will also ensure that this identification process becomes an integral part of it, because we want to ensure that there is an electronic file, but a file that is opened for Jenny when she is admitted, and it travels with her right the way through the system. And that should Jenny come back in again at some point, unless she's coming in under an alias with a different, a false ID, et cetera, and that's always one of the risks that one is dealing with. But that process actually kicks in. But if that RDOMS process is biometrically determined on the basis of fingerprints, even if I come in with a false ID and a different name and a different hairstyle and whatever else I want to change, the thumbprint is at least going to pick me up. So there are other additional checks and balances that we are building in as we go forward. But that identification then is meant to determine who the person is, what their name is, and the registration of that and their thumbprint. Again, a point at which a clear process of ensuring that you're comfortable with the information that is being made available. At the moment, it is not that easy to identify that this is somebody who has been in our facilities before. It's not necessarily that easy to pick up that somebody has got an alias. Those are issues going forward that we will increasingly pick up on. The next part of the process, that obviously also deals with the issue of, is this a remand detainee, is this an offender, what is the sentence that they're facing, those types of issues that are important in terms of the section of the centre that they may be going into. The filing and the keeping of warrants is also a critical part. The process of translating the body receipt and the warrants into our register is a critical part of being able to ensure that there is a single database in every correctional centre as to who is there, and the process of physical verification of head counts of inmates is done against that register. So we file them according to sentence category, we file them according to the registration number sequence, or according to the release date. So there are a variety of different mechanisms there that enable us to track them. The separation of inmates is a critical aspect. There are centres in which we have a juvenile section and an adult section in the same physical building but as two distinct units. So that process of ensuring that if you're admitting a youth, the youth goes into the youth section and doesn't go into the adult section, particularly relevant when you're dealing with children under 18. But it also, in some instances, would be that the physical building of a centre is divided into a male section and a female section, closed off and with no communication in between the sections, two separate elements. So those processes of ensuring that according to what's on the warrant, the segregation, the separation of categories of inmates is complied with is also a critical part of the process in centres. Obviously, in centres in which it is a youth centre, a youth development centre, the 15 that we have, nobody other than the warrant would then specifically say Jenny is a youth and she is going into that particular centre. So the warrant specifies the centre. Where there is a centre with a particular section, that again should be identified. We spoke last week on the issue of the vulnerable categories, and I would do want to pick up on that aspect here, because it's at that point that the issue of looking at the vulnerable categories should kick in. We do have cases of people with particular sexual orientations. We spoke about that last week. There are a variety of different categories of people that need to be picked up on it at that point. The correct process is that somebody who has, for example, we could well have people who, although biologically of a particular gender, choose to dress in the opposite gender. We could have people who physically are either of one or the other, but their identity, their own self-conception is something other than what their biological determination is. We could have people who are going through a medical process and in terms of a sex change. Now, those categories of people should, in fact, be kept outside of communal cells, they should be either accommodated in single cells or accommodated in the hospital section. And that, again, is part of this process right at the beginning. What's an important part of this process is, and it's done under the medical examination, so I'm going to change the order a little bit for the logic of what I'm speaking to. But that medical examination is an important part of the admission. It needs to take place within the first 24 hours. It is important in terms of being able to determine whether a person has any medical conditions, but it's also important in terms of the softer side of certain health and medical and emotional issues that feed into the separation and the classification of inmates. It's also then at this stage that the issues of inmates' cash and valuable items and private clothing are dealt with. I'm not going to deal with those in detail because I don't think that those are particularly relevant to the concern that I'm sure is in the minds of members of Parliament in relation to the admission process and the wrong admission of somebody to a centre. There are also obviously then issues of personal hygiene that kick in at that initial stage. As soon as possible after admission, inmates are meant to be given an opportunity to take a bath of shower and be able to ensure that a high standard of personal hygiene is set during those processes. That's also when people are given their prescribed toiletries, unless they have their own toiletries in their possession. A critical element also at this point is that is the stage at which inmates are meant to be orientated to the centre. That is the stage at which they are meant to be explained in a broad sense, the rules of the house, in a sense. That should include the access that inmates have to lodging complaints, to phone calls to their families, notification of their next of kin, in other words, to access to the medical personnel. So there's an orientation process there that is particularly important as a check and balance on any inmate that has any discomfort. I mean, obviously, all of us are uncomfortable when we're being admitted to any correctional facility. It's not a nice process. But leaving that discomfort aside, for example, if I was being wrongly treated at that point, that orientation should say to me that I have the right to lodge that complaint right there and there with the person who's dealing with me, certainly with the nurse, when the nurse is doing a medical examination, that I have a right to notify my next of kin, which means that if something is happening there that should not be, that is a violation of my rights in any sense, that process could also be used to say there's a problem, as well as obviously the role of the inspecting judge, the visits from the IPVs, the complaints taken by the head of centre, the role of the unit manager in terms of being able to address those issues. So that orientation, if taken seriously and if understood by the person concerned, because I think that we also need to acknowledge that the admission to a correctional centre is a traumatic process, and at times one doesn't absorb the necessary information in that first interaction that one should, and that's why it's important that the orientation is actually followed up on as the person settles in to a correctional centre. Obviously, the importance of that orientation is there's no point in me giving an orientation in tertiary institution language English to somebody whose home language is Sesotho and whose literacy level is minimal. So the key issue that we've had to engage with in terms of that orientation is to ensure that there are a variety of different media that can be used, and that where translation is necessary, it is provided. And those are obviously critical elements of communication with an inmate when they are admitted. The notification of the next of kin, that is an opportunity for an inmate to be able to say to your family, I'm at Centre X. The process obviously needs to be provided by the information needs to be provided by that inmate. So there are situations in which people choose not to inform their next of kin. But if that is the choice, that is one of the things that needs to be indicated on the back of a warrant, and the inmate needs to sign that entry, so that we don't land up in a situation which people disappear into our facilities with families saying, why didn't the person tell me? And we have not recorded that, in fact, it was Jenny's choice. She didn't want her parents to know that she was in that center. Okay, then the issue then obviously is the process of providing the identity cards provided as soon as possible after admission, and that's part of what then sustains the identification of that person during the course of their time in our facilities. What is important is to note that in terms of remand detention, this admission process is done every time somebody goes out to court. There's a repeat process in terms of remand detention because there's no guarantee that when Jenny goes to court in the morning, she's necessarily coming back in the afternoon. So there is a process in which this is repeated during the remand detention period. Okay, then the next item obviously deals with the opening of offender files, and that's then leading into the correctional sentence plan processes. The calculation and recording of release dates for sentenced offenders is also part of this process, so that right from the beginning, on the basis of what's on the warrant, those calculations are done in terms of the maximum release date, consideration for parole, and that's dependent on the nature of the category that you have been sentenced under or the law that you've been sentenced under, as well as our policy, and then obviously any non-parole dates, that periods that may be determined by court. That includes then indicating right as from day one what your parole consideration dates would be. The admission process also involves a searching process. The searching process is designed to be able to determine whether there are any unauthorized objects that are being brought into our facilities. And it's obviously one of the points in the admission process in which the relationship between our security and the inmate security, for that matter, but the security of the facility and all of the people connected with it is balanced against the human right of the individual. The searches, there is a procedure that is laid down for the searches. The purpose of the searches is to identify any unauthorized objects. A strip search is only entitled to be done if there is a belief that there is, in fact, an unauthorized object that is being concealed. So that's not the starting point. The starting point is merely a patting down search. The search is meant to be done by somebody of the same gender. Obviously, where it is meant to be done with as much respect for the human dignity of the person who's being searched as possible, ideally not in the middle of an audience of 100 people. Obviously, that is something that the physical infrastructure of your admission center determines. There are places in which it can be done in cubicles. There are places in which it isn't. But again, that's a question of how the center chooses to find a way to minimize the humiliation process of that search. Obviously, where it's a strip search, that has to be done in privacy, and certainly has to be done by somebody who is of the same gender. Okay, so the searching process then takes place to determine whether there are any unauthorized articles. That is the purpose of it. It is not a purpose of identification of gender. It would be more appropriate than using the searching process in terms of any gender questions to use medical personnel rather than to use a searching process in relation to that. But there is, in terms of the procedure for security reasons, a searching process to ensure that unauthorized objects are not smuggled into the process. Then the final element of it, obviously, is ensuring that the computer records of this process are there and that there is a consistent updating of information in relation to it. There is a process of the physical headcounts verifying against the register so that we ensure that we've got the same number of people in our facilities at any time. The management reports are meant to be drawn on a weekly or monthly basis by the supervisor of case administration to verify that, in fact, all of the information is accurate. The head of center is meant to do that on a monthly basis, looking at particular categories of of offenders, young offenders, are we dealing with them in an appropriate way? Are there offenders with further charges? When are the further charges? Inmates with expired court dates, so that is picked up timeously and people don't land up in our facilities with expired court dates and no process. And picking up effectively on any anomalies, if, for example, in the records at some point there isn't a release date, that's wrong, because everybody is admitted with a clear release date. It's on your warrant when you come in as a sentenced offender, or it's on your warrant when you come in as a remand detainee because you've got a court date, which effectively is your release date. You may well be admitted again that next day. So there is a constant process in which the accuracy of this information should be being verified, and the process is then activated to ensure that where there are gaps in information, or anomalies in information, contradictions in information, it is picked up on and taken forward. Chairperson, I hope through talking you through that process, I've given a sense of the admission process that needs to be followed. And I want you to repeat that process has a variety of checks and balances in it, that if due diligence is applied by the court officials, by the SATS officials, by our own correctional officials at admission, and in terms of the ongoing drawing of reports and checking of those reports, erroneous admissions should not happen, or they should be picked up on and addressed in an immediate sense. The checks and balances, obviously, for the inmate are being able to access their families, being able to access the daily complaint system, being able to access medical personnel, or being able to access the IPVs as they come through. What for me is extremely important is that if there are data integrity issues in the very first stages of that admission, you can then land up with subsequent processes that are going to pick it up. So the relationship between the court officials, the SATS officials, and the DCS officials at that point of admission, be it on the first day that the person is admitted or in relation to remand detainees, each time that person is admitted, if there is not a very thorough attention to detail and to going back to the previous originator of that information if there are anomalies and ensuring complete compliance with those processes, that is the crunch in terms of ensuring that we do not land up with erroneous admission. Chairperson, I hope that we've been able to give you a sense of the individual case. What we will commit ourselves to once that court process is finalized is to submit in writing to the Portfolio Committee the outcome of that process and be able to explain it in detail, but it is sub judice. But we thought that by dealing with the admission process, you would then be able to get a sense of the checks and balances and be able to pinpoint for us if there are elements of concern going forward that can be attended to. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think as a committee we will respect the fact that this matter is before the court, but there are still certain questions that we can ask, I think, that would not necessarily jeopardize the proceedings before the court. I'm hoping that members would accept that. So we're going to check each question as it's asked. But I mean questions like what has happened to the officials that were involved at the time. Are they still in the department or not in the department? I don't think that is going to jeopardize the court cases. So I'm appealing to members that when you engage, let us bear in mind that there are specifics that the department might not be able to answer today because of the 5th of May's hearing, but there are certainly others that we can ask. So that's how I suggest we handle it. And I will recognize members now, but by your own admission, you know, Commissioner, just listening to this input, and even if there were no individuals involved, at best I can say that this is not worth the paper or the policy that you have is worthless in terms of the process. Because if I look at your policy, what you've been saying to me, and what you say the policy contains, one, you say that there should be a medical within 24 hours. I'm sure that would have told us that this is a male, a female, a child, or whatever. So either your medical examinations are totally inadequate or they didn't take place at all. You then say that every person that is brought in is subject to a search. Surely, that search should be able to indicate to me whether I'm male or female. And the second thing that worries me is that if we don't even know that, it means there's male searching females and female searching males. So it raises all those type of questions. And then my understanding is that I don't have a choice of where I'm going to be detained. If I'm a juvenile, I go to a juvenile. If I'm a female, I go to a female. If I'm a male, I go to a male. That's my understanding from what you've presented or what your policy presents to us. And yet we had this particular situation that seems like this went through the cracks. And then the final point that I just want to raise so that you flag them, and when members ask you, you respond to me as well as to what members might ask specifically. You see, you say that individual A goes to the courts, the court then sentences him to incarceration. Steps then take him from the court to the facility. The question that you would need to respond to is that when people are transported from the court to the facility, do we have a situation where in one police van we have male and female being transported to the facility? Because when it's male and male, already we have abuse just between those two areas. So if it's male and female, do they travel in one police van? Because surely if there was a police van for males and a police van for females, in itself it would almost eradicate the possibility of these people being mixed up in the cell. So it's those type of things that raise serious concerns for me. And thus I'm saying that your policy is just not worth anything. Just on the basis of that, I thought I must start and set that scene without getting into the details, because that's worrisome. But I'm going to ask members who want to ask questions, you'll engage with them until you're satisfied, we'll move on to the next one. But we will try and limit all of you to at least 5 minutes so that everybody has a chance. Mr. Self would then be followed. You can go in that order, Mr. Self, Mr. Fritz, and then Ms. Ngwenya. And Fritz, Gwenya, and then Mamnyanda, and then we'll take a second round if we need to. But if you could limit it to about 5 minutes, then we can have a second round. Mr. Self,
thank you very much, Chair, and thanks to the Acting National Commissioner for that information. What disturbed me, and it really follows from your question, Chair, was the number of times that Jenny said ought to, should be, shouldn't happen, if taken seriously, meant to be, and it gives me the impression that actually that this is a policy that's in place, but we don't know whether it's really complied with. And I would like to know to what extent the department ensures on a consistent and coherent basis that these policies are actually complied with. Because a couple of years ago we went to Polsmore and we interacted with a medical doctor there, and one of the things that medical doctor told me was that the medical checks that are supposed to be done within 24 hours are very rarely done at all, never mind within 24 hours. There are a variety of other things that are simply not complied with because the management structures are not there to ensure that compliance actually occurs. The second thing that worries me slightly is that even within that admission, assuming that admission policy was complied with, there are countless opportunities, I would have thought, for abuse along that process. In the van, as you, Chair, correctly said, in the shower, you know, what happens if a medical examination only takes place within 24 hours? What happens in the 18 hours before the medical examination takes place. We are the people housed. And specifically in the relation to the conversation that we had last week, at what stage are vulnerable people identified? Transgender people, pretty boys, those sorts of things that are going to stop abuse from taking place. And finally, reference was made to a biometric process that is being rolled out. Can we have information about where it's being rolled out and when it is likely that it will be rolled out across the entire correction centres? Thank you, Chair.
Chairperson, in relation to the concern about the policy and the ought, obviously this particular case that has generated this discussion has raised precisely the concern that there are problems. It is possible to subvert the policy. I think that the elements are there for this policy to be very firmly implemented if the checks and balances are followed. We have, in as much as this is a case of a real situation which it didn't, we have other cases in which the attention to detail by members have prevented an erroneous release of somebody who had been given a release date when in fact their case was subject to an appeal. So I do want to emphasize that as much as this is a case in which it ought not to have happened, there are other cases in which the reverse has happened. The supervisory roles, the process of signing off on the data integrity, the process of the checks and balances, that drawing of management reports, is a critical element of being able to ensure that this policy indeed is complied with. I don't want to, because we are focusing on an issue that has come up from a case in which compliance was not there, to land up where we create an impression that there is no compliance. The issue of the medical checks is obviously a critical challenge for us. It is a situation in which we do not have the appropriate number of medical personnel, and I'm not using that as an excuse because it should take place, but the Portfolio Committee is aware of the challenges that we have in terms of the appropriate numbers of personnel at appropriate points in time. It is in that particular period at which the vulnerable categories should be being identified. Depending on the volume of people that are in place and the particular system in that facility, there are different systems in place for how people get accommodated, whether there is a 24-hour holding cell that enables people to be processed, all people are able to go directly. If you are dealing with a small centre, it's far easier to say, here's somebody that ultimately goes into that section, they move immediately. If you're in the Joburg Remand Detention Facility, you're dealing with vast numbers of people coming back from court, and there's therefore a holding process that enables a process going forward. So it's very difficult to answer that with complete absoluteness, because our centres are so vastly, vastly different. There are obviously also processes in which people are being admitted as transfers from centre to centre rather than directly from court processes, which again has a different dimension, but with the same protection mechanisms being in place in relation to it. In relation to the countless points to use your phrasing, countless opportunities along a process in which there are opportunities for abuse. It's not possible to design a system that can completely eliminate those opportunities. The critical element is, do we have the necessary checks and balances and the necessary supervision at each of those stages along the way? And that is an issue of whether we have the right capacity at the right points in time. And our medical personnel, certainly in terms of the abuse and the picking up of abuse, particularly where abuse may have happened in a previous process in relation to the admission of inmates, it could be abuse between leaving one centre and coming to another. It could be abuse between the court and here. We the issue of the role of medical personnel does become a critical one, and it is part of our concern is that we do not have the capacity to be able to ensure that those are done in terms of what the policy requires, the process. The issue of the biometric rollout, I don't have details in my head at the moment, but we can certainly provide the detail of that process going forward and indicate how that process is being rolled out. I'm sure the Portfolio Committee will be aware of the fact that it originates from the inmate tracking project and it's now being disaggregated into rolling out a biometric identification process as the first phase of ultimately getting to a proper inmate tracking process. Chairperson, just as I'm talking on this, to touch on some of the issues that you had raised, it's perfectly true that an inmate does not determine where you are going to be accommodated, which centre you're going to be accommodated in. That is an issue that is determined by the person who issues the warrant. So that is a court-driven process. Until the person is in our facilities, has been admitted into our facilities, in which case our transfer policy then kicks in. And I think that in the previous meeting we had spoken to the circumstances under which that transfer process kicks in. And that's why I put the emphasis on the importance of ensuring that there is integrity from the stage of the issuing of the warrant to the translation of those warrants into the SAPS 216, the what we call the body receipt, because if there's a data integrity problem there, that's the beginning of our set of problems. SAPS transports men and women separately. So there should be a van of people that takes women to a women's facility. There should be a van of people that takes men to a men's facility. If in that process the data integrity, the accuracy, the attention to detail in that process does not take place, again, what that is doing then is saying that the vigilance of our officials in picking up that here is a warrant that says X, here is a warrant that says you should be in a youth development centre and you're being admitted to an adult facility. They may be a youth centre and an adult facility within the same management area, but you've then been brought to the wrong facility. Our personnel cannot legally admit that person to a centre if the warrant says that you're meant to be in another centre. What they should do is to then say, I have somebody standing in front of me who looks like they are 45, and yet this warrant says that they should be in a youth development centre. I don't believe that this person is a youth. Get back to the court. The court confirms this person indeed is a youth, but they've got some disease that ages them prematurely. Fine, we admit the person. Or there's a process of checking up, and indeed there is an error in the court. And that's the other case that I was talking to, of where we have recognized excellence in a member who picked up and prevented somebody who was serving a life sentence from being erroneously released because of what came from the court was wrong. It's that diligence that actually enables us to then ensure that those issues are picked up on. That is also the point at which an official has got the scope to say, for example, we are not meant to have children in our facilities under the age of 14. A child comes in, you look at that child looks to you like an 11-year-old. And that's the stage at which the utilization of medical personnel to be able to verify, indeed, on a medical examination, this kid is a 15-year-old, despite the fact that they're small in stature and very slight. Those checks and balances are critically important elements of the admissions process, and they should be being picked up on right at the admissions process. The elements that feed into those processes not being done effectively would obviously be elements where there's direct fraud and corruption, and that may be fraud and corruption that starts from the issuing of a warrant. It may be in the SAPS 216 process. It may be within our facilities. But that is an element that we need to acknowledge. Part of what we then need to ensure is we've got the checks and balances to be able to pick up on the fact that this is something that is wrong. It can also be made more difficult to be vigilant in a situation in which you are admitting large numbers of people and you've got a level of overcrowding. And I don't say that as a defense. as a justification of it, but it's the circumstances under which some of these issues take place, where you've got vast numbers of people coming from court. The diligence to detail is sometimes what stacks, and that's not as an excuse. It's unacceptable. The policy is there precisely to ensure that we comply with the law, which states very clearly you can only admit somebody on the basis of a warrant to that particular centre, that the warrants and the body receipt correlate completely, and that the necessary internal compliance processes are then complied within our department.
Thanks, Vasana. Let's allow members to ask their questions. We've got someone to leave a bit earlier, and then you'll be able to respond. But I noted Mr. Fritz, Ms. Ngwenya, and then Mam Nyanda.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the diligence is applied in by officials to keep people in prison, to not release the life, instead of checking whether people should be in prison. I think that's the point more, Ms. Commissioner. I think I have to raise a number of issues. I think we have 7 very, very big remand detention centres in the country. It's Paulsmo, it's Johannesburg, it's Pretoria, it is Durban, Westville, it's in Aldens. And I think it's at those centres that we have the most problems. I can say, I don't know if anyone has been to any one of those centres during admission. It is frightening how body searches are done. Absolutely, to every single one, you get stripped, and you must jump in front of everyone. I'm just making just that first point about body searches. So you have a very beautiful B orders. I don't know if it's called B orders. I don't know. But very clear guidelines how it should be done. But, as Mr. Self said, I mean, the medical exam never takes place. I mean, someone looks at you. I can almost on authority say that. What I find frightening about this case, and I don't want to discuss the case, but the principle of the case, is that how would... Even with independent prison visitors not picking a person up like that and not reporting that to the inspecting judge. I'm just making that point, and I think we really need to start looking at the effectiveness of independent prison visitors and the role, and whether they not also becoming institutionalized after 2 years and a year in prison, and they become like all other orders, which don't care or appears not to care about that. Another interesting thing, I was in Goodwood a week ago, and good correctional center. There was a man who almost cried, please phone my family, And we know with that volumes people coming from court, most people in our areas like Kailicha, in areas where people don't have landlines, depend on cell phones. Now, you ask any prison warden to phone a cell phone, I know what I'm talking about. That was exactly my point I asked. They don't allow people to make phone calls to cell phones. I can imagine the cost implications there. So I'm saying, these policies, I mean, it sounds incredibly great, but it's so romantic, Mr. Chair. It's not applicable. Let us get policies that's workable and that can be applied. I think that those are my... The other last point I want to make. I think in admissions, we really need to get people who have absolute empathy, who have human rights, which is again another romantic notion. But people with some empathy to work in admissions, and not just to get and the way people are treated. I think we really should do a visit or a night visit to Paulsmo and not tell anyone that we're coming to go and look at admissions at Paulsmo. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think it's going to be difficult for us because this case is in the court right now. But now we've got these guidelines that is talking nice as if things are happening. And according to me, things are not happening, ma'am. Because if the department was following the guidelines that Jeannie is talking about right now, we'll never have this case that is in the court right now. At the first place, on the admission. The person when gets in there, after they record the person and do whatever, I believe that person is going to the shower. And when this person goes to the shower, there's a ward that is there that is looking for all these inmates that are getting in and strip them and gave them a soap to wash, and when they wash, they also check that person that is it this person really a man or a woman. But now if we've got a chairperson, a case whereby a woman is crying that was in the center of the man, it doesn't look like these guidelines is implemented in our centers. I don't know how to handle this, but it looks like a chair. We need to give ourselves time. I don't know how, because some of the people, they come late to the court just to watch when they admit people, that is it really, really this thing happened, or is it on just on the paper? And why the department wait until this thing comes to the paper and all that without checking themselves what is happening? Because right now we'll be knowing what is happening in that center. Why was that woman was there? Who doing this? Really, it's painful. Even people outside there, they're complaining about this thing. You'll find that there are more complaints, more than the woman that was brave and come out and said I've been abused in our correctional center. I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. I heard the commissioner telling us that the offenders are transported by SEPs from court to the correctional center. I don't know if they leave the court, do they have the files, or they just leave the court and take that person to the correctional center. Because if they leave the court with the files and everything, it's written there that this is Florence Nyanda. She's sentenced for 2 months or 3 months. It's Florence Nyanda, not Floyd Nyanda. There's a difference between the two names. The search, when they hand over that offender at the correctional center, the person who admitted the offender there, was she not aware the name that was written there, or she did it deliberately? If I can get that answer. We were at Bloemfontein Correctional Center. We took all the rounds there. To my surprise, I don't know whether it was me alone, we went to one center, inmate cell there. There was a lady, or I don't know whether it's a lady or if she's a maid, by the name of Queen. She had her wig on, makeup, but that cell, it was male cell. If you can tell me that Queen, the name is Queen.
Queenie.
If she or he, I don't know. And at the same time, when the offender is sentenced with the files and everything to the correctional center, the official who's admitting this offender, him also, he must account how did he admit this person there. Because, as I'm saying, they must tell us, although the case is in court right now, I don't know who's going to tell us when they open the admission for that offender. Didn't she see, he or he see that this is a woman or a male? My second question, or at the same time, it's guidelines. The identity of an inmate must be properly determined immediately after admission. That's my question. My third question is, the head of correctional center or an official authorized must be addressed all the new admission, including escapee, whoever. What did the official did when this poor woman was in that center. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chairperson. May God bless you, man. You, this is painful, Chairperson. Hurting, disturbing, disappointing, you name them. Commissioner, what I want to ask is the question that was asked by the Chairperson. I didn't hear you answering that. Where are the officers who were there by the time this was happening? Are they still there? If yes, what happened to them? If not, what happened to them? If you can explain that or you can answer that question, I can be very, very happy, because all this depends to those officers who were there. We can talk and talk and talk and involve many people to this case, but the people who are responsible for this are the officers who were there. Are they still there? Yeah. I, if I can see them, Chairperson, I, yo, take.
Our guests for the second part have arrived. They will bear with us just for a few minutes. But I think it's related to what we're going to discuss with you anyway, so I'm sure you're going to benefit from it. But Ms. Fine, if you could respond to that one, to those few questions.
Chairperson, thank you. I think that the issues raised by Mr. Fritzens, in some senses, I have already touched on. The big remand centres is indeed a major concern in terms of the admissions, particularly given that it is in a remand detention centre. It is a daily process. It is one of the key elements that needs to be addressed in terms of the infrastructural requirements and staffing requirements of a remand detention centre, and it's part of the process of why we have a remand detention project, to be able to look at how do we ensure that we've got the appropriate resources at the appropriate places in a remand detention centre, because it is a fundamentally different process from a correctional centre. So we would acknowledge the challenges currently in our big remand detention centres, because they were not designed specifically to facilitate the remand detention processes. What it does mean, though, is that what we are expecting then is a high level of diligence from our staff in those centres, but particularly difficult given the number of people that are going on board. The medical exam, I've already acknowledged that the personnel are not in place to do that as policy requires. It is an issue that we need to look at going forward. The issue of the IPV is not picking up on it. And the concern that IPVs are being institutionalized. I think obviously it's a real concern, not in relation to IPVs, in relation to all of us with any role in relation to correctional services, that you can get to a point where you become institutionalized, and how does one ensure that that does not take place. But I do want to say that, and it's a difficult question for me to answer because I have the detailed facts of this case, which I have not been able to share with you. But I do want to say on a number of instances, and I think that when the court case is over and we are able to engage with you on the details of it, you will take some comfort from this process. If I, as an inmate, faced with an IPV, do not use that opportunity to say, I mean, if I put myself in a situation in which I am being put as a remand detainee into a sentenced section, the correctional officials are going to have to drag me there because I'm going to protest. If I'm being put into an adult centre as a kid, I'm going to kick and scream. Now, I'm talking as somebody who knows my rights, and if I don't know my rights, obviously I'm less inclined to do that. But there's a process in which there's an onus on the inmate to use the opportunity to flag it. If those opportunities are not used, what does that indicate? and it can indicate that I don't know that I've got rights.
Can I interrupt?
We'll allow you to interrupt at some point. Continue, Ms. Frank.
What I'm trying to say is that there is an element of concern that we need to ensure that our officials aren't becoming institutionalized, our heads of centers aren't becoming institutionalized, the police aren't becoming institutionalized, that our admission officials do indeed have an empathy and a human rights, while at the same time also having a very strong security backbone, because they are the starting point of the security of the institution. But I don't want us to say that this particular case means that IPVs have become institutionalized, because I don't see it from the facts that I have at my disposal. The issue of the landlines and the cell phones, I take that point on board, and we will certainly look at what the policy is. But what's also important is that it's not only telephonic communication. There is also the process of people being able to put things in writing in order to be able to notify families, which it's not as immediate. You can well land up where there's a delay of days while you're in the centre and your family doesn't know where you are. But there are other mechanisms of that notification. But the cell phones issue we will take on board, bearing in mind the cost implications. But the important part is to be able to facilitate the communication with the family. It's perfectly true that if the guidelines were in fact followed meticulously from the court process right the way through, this case would not have materialized in the way that it did. I don't want to go further on that, because it's the facts of the case that will actually indicate the process going forward. The process of the issue of the transporting of the police from the transporting by police from the courts. Indeed, the person comes with the warrant. So as you are not admitting just a human being, you're admitting a human being with the legal instrument that says you are entitled to detain, and obliged to detain that person in that centre. If that warrant says, here's Jenny, and she needs to be detained in Palsmore Female, and in fact they've taken me to Goodwood. Goodwood Headed Centre is not entitled to admit me. I need to be referred back to where I'm meant to be. And that is where I'm emphasizing the diligence of the data integrity of that documentation, but also the diligence of the officials acting according to the documentation that is in front of them. The body receipt, again, it comes with the inmate. So if I'm a police officer and I'm delivering 10 people to Palsmore Maximum, there is a That's 216 that says, and that's what we refer to as the body receipt. Here you've got 10 people. This is who the 10 people are, and there need to be 10 warrants. All of those 10 warrants need to say, this is Jenny, and she's going to Palsmore Maximum. This is Shishi, she's going to Palsmore Maximum. If in the admission process there is a disjuncture there, the admission process should stop in order to go back and verify those details. So it is a very clear process that there are places all the way along the line where any problem should be picked up. The issues of why in this particular instance it wasn't, we will leave until the end of the court case process. On the issue of the inmate that was referred to in relation to Mangaung, I'm not going to speak specifically to that individual, but I do want to flag for the portfolio committee. And I think that I touched on it in my very opening remarks. And I think that we have touched on it also in relation to people who are vulnerable in our discussion last week. There are categories of inmates, small though they are, of people who are vulnerable because of their gender identity. There are people who are transvestite. There are people, in other words, they are clearly male, but they dress as women, or they're clearly female, but they dress and behave as male. There are people who are biologically transsexual. They have both male and female hormones or bodies. That is something that may be picked up in a medical examination, but it equally may not be, because it may not be external, it may be internal. Those are the complexities that exist, as we are aware, in broader society. when they come into our facilities, they put people in a even more vulnerable position than those people would be outside. There's a third category of people who may be going through a sex change process, a medical process of changing their bodies. Those people may well, at a certain point in that process, either have a predominantly male hormone, and I'm talking now as a woman transforming into a man, a male hormone process, but a female physical body, or they may have, at a certain point in that process, have both. Those are complexities. Now, that medical examination becomes critically important in terms of being able to identify that. Our policy is that that category of people should be being held either in single cell or in a hospital section. And that is the degree of protection that we have in place for those people at that point, and at the admission process and obviously throughout their stay. Those are some of the issues that we need to ensure that we are able to better manage than we are. And again, whether those issues get picked up on to the extent that they should depends on how well one has trained the admission staff to be able to be sensitive to those issues. Whether that is a person who's being admitted on their own so that full attention can be paid to all the detail, or that is a person who's being admitted as part of a batch of 500 people who've come from court on that particular day. It doesn't give anybody an excuse for people not being dealt with accordingly. But I think what I'm trying to reflect to the Portfolio Committee is that there are the complexities of the human beings that we are dealing with. The head of centre addressing the new admissions, again, it's a very important part of the process. It's a very important part that we had reviewed in, I would think, the 2000-2003 process of trying to ensure that what is articulated at that point of time is articulated in a way that is meaningful to inmates, that it is not something that is delivered in whatever the home language is of the head of centre, and that is not delivered in DCS speak, because we all understand our processes and our forms and our whatever else, but as somebody who's recently been admitted to a centre, that's foreign, it's alien, and it's traumatic. So we had put a particular emphasis on that orientation manual of members. Part of what this kind of case brings back is the importance of, from time to time, refreshing the emphasis with heads of centres to say that orientation process is indeed a critically important part of it. And I had indicated last week that we are moving into an interaction process between our minister and the heads of centres and the heads of centres training program, and each time these issues are reflected back, we are flagging them as issues that should be taken into both the interaction between the minister and the heads of centres, but also into our training processes. I think the final element is the issue of what has been done in relation to the members concerned. And that is a process that the Regional Commission of KZN is at the moment in the process of determining, remembering that this is a process that happened in 2002-03. There was an investigation done there. There were very clear recommendations, a whole series of findings that were mapped out of that, and he's currently in the process of mapping those recommendations against steps that have been taken and then determining what processes need to take forward. I'm not in a position to give you the final outcome of exactly what each of those steps is, but to say that there are issues there that he is in the process of ensuring are taken through to their logical conclusion. And again, perhaps, Chairperson, that's something that as he completes that process, we can put in writing back to you the issues of those processes. Our concern is that there indeed were issues that should have been addressed very timely at the time that don't appear to have received the focused attention of the then area commissioner. We now have a different area commissioner in Durban Westville, and we are in the process, or the regional commissioner is in the process of attending to those aspects going forward.
Chairperson, the Correctional Service Act 111 of 1998 states very clearly the role and the functions, duties, and something of the independent prison visitors. And one of it is that they should visit every part of a prison. They should have access to every document and to every part of the prison. And the onus is not on a vulnerable prisoner to get to the IPV. The onus is on the IPV to get to exactly that vulnerable prison. That's the rationale behind the act. The training manual of the IPV also clearly states that they have to go and visit every part of the center, specifically single cells, specifically where people are punished unnecessarily or whatever. But I'm saying there's also institutional rumor that you pick it up. I don't want to discuss the case, but I came and then the next day I discovered that the person was there and the person was released because we... the point I want to make is institutional rumor. Everyone knows about it in the prison. And if you're IPV and you're stationed there and you're for a while there, surely you should pick it up. That is my point. It's not the onus of the person to get to the IPV, but the IPV should get to everyone who's vulnerable. Thanks, Miss.
Thank you. That was a comment. Just two things, Ms. Feiner, before we move to the next one. The first one, indeed, maybe you're not the correct person to talk to in terms of IPVs. We will get the inspector in touch here. I received also from an IPV or an ex-IPV report of what's happening in Portsmouth. That for me is very scary, and I have asked Cindy and company to forward that to you for your comment and forward it to the inspecting judge for their comment, and on the basis of that we will deal with it. So it will deal with the matters of really what the IPVs are supposed to be doing, what they're not doing, and the allegations in that letter. I just wanted to bring that to our attention. We will deal with that matter shortly. Just quickly, Ms. Feiner, when did you say the court case is happening?
12th of May.
All right. We are on the 12th of May. On the 12th of May.
It's down on the magistrate's roll for the 12th of May.
Okay.
I don't know how long it's going to
all
take,
right.
But that's the date.
It doesn't help us too much. I was going to suggest, I thought it was before the 12th of May, because beyond the 12th of May, we are away until the 26th of May as a committee. The 12th of May is our last day here. But I received a note from members saying that, look, but we understand that this matter is before the courts. The department is aware of it. Why don't we just have a closed session and ask the media to go out so that we can be informed? And I was going to suggest that we postpone it until the 12th of May and we don't have to disrupt the meeting because anyway we have the next agenda item on it. But the 12th of May being the date of the court case, I'm not sure if the department has to be represented there. But what I am saying is that I think the members' concerns are legit. If indeed on the 12th of May the case is still going on, and we need to have a closed session just to get the detail of this matter, we're going to do that on the 12th of May. So. On the 12th of May, we were supposed to be dealing with security-related matters with the department. So if somebody comes in and gives us a briefing on this matter, even if it means for 10 minutes we ask our friends from the media to excuse us until we get that briefing and we get them back for the rest of the deliberations, we will do that. But on the 12th of May, Madam Dhaka, hopefully we will get as much detail as possible. That was the last item that I thought I wanted to raise on this matter. Ms. Feiner, the final one as well. On the 12th of May, hopefully you'll come and answer the questions that were raised about what has happened to these individuals. We need to know. We need to know if these individuals are still in the system, what was the sanction, if indeed they were in the system and they were at fault, or if they were not at fault, that they be cleared at least, so that we answer to the South African population at large that the fault was not with the department, but the fault was with, partly the department and partly the party that is making the allegation and so on. But I do think that on this matter that is, for us, a very important matter, because it's a case study of whether this policy can work. And that is why we're going to pursue it to the very end. At the 12th of May, we will continue, and if there are hindrances, we will take it beyond the 12th of May, because if we get this right, I believe that we won't have this type of problem in the future. So thank you very much. I'm hoping that members in agreement that we wait until the 12th of May to conclude on all the matters. Just to remind you again, it's what happened to the personnel that were involved. where this matter is exactly at that date, the detail that you say you have at your disposal. We'd want you to share that with us, even if it's within a closed session. We will share that matter, and if it's in the courts, then it means it becomes public information, isn't it? When once it's gone to court, it's public. So we will decide on the morning. I'm just warning my friends from the media. On the morning of that 12th, we'll decide whether we will ask you to excuse us or whether we will have a meeting like we have now, an open meeting. But it will be dependent on exactly where the processes are. Just on this item, the other items for the 12th would be an open meeting as per usual. As per the request of members that say they think they should have access to that information if it is available. Thank you very much, Ms. Reiner, on that item. If we then can move, and I want to apologize once again to our friends from health. We did say to you 10 o'clock, it's half an hour late or 20 minutes late. Apologies for that, but I do think that what has come out of here has a direct bearing on health and the relationship between the two departments. We'd ask the committee, I beg your pardon, we'd ask the department to come and brief us on health care within the Department of Correctional Services. Now, we know that there is a very close liaison, link, responsibility, obligation between the department and yourselves in health. So we thought it would be wise for us to invite you as well to share this meeting with us. And we would also ask the portfolio committee to be here because we think it's an important matter. And this is continuously what we are doing as correctional services. Just because we are reliant on so many other role players. For the media and for our colleagues from health so that they don't feel as if they are in the hot seat. The context is when we discuss buildings, we ask Public Works to come and talk to us together with the department. Today's health, we've asked you from health to come and at least share with us from your perspective, so that oversight is effective. And next week, we'll be asking the education people to come together with the department. So that when the department says to us the fault lies with education, we are able to look at the DG and say, Mr. DG, do you agree or don't you agree? So that we can allow this to resolve the problem. So that is the context in which we'd asked you to attend. And please feel free to participate as freely as all of us have participated. I have no indication that you wanted to do a specific presentation, but if after the presentation of Jenny you wanted to add to it, we'd allow you to add to it, and then we'd ask members to then engage with it afterwards. So if the department feels like doing so after the presentation from the department, they can do us. And just for the record, we have in our midst, the acting DG, Dr. Jürgen Pillay. Jürgen, am I spelling correct? Jürgen Pillay, welcome DG. And we also have Mr. Tulani Masilela, who is the Unit Director for Strategic Planning. Welcome to you, Director. And then we have from the Portfolio Committee two representatives, the Chairperson and Ms. Dube, Chairperson, Mr. Kokwana. I hope I'm pronouncing it Kokwana. If I'm not, apologies, Chair. So the Chairperson and a representative from the Portfolio Committee are here. Welcome and thank you very much for joining us in what we think is a very important engagement we have. Ms. Reiner, it is half past 10. Can we give you about 15 minutes or so? I don't know how long you need to do your presentation. We will then ask the department if they want to add to or dispute, and then we'll open it up for comments, because there are matters that I think members of the committee want to raise. The floor is yours, Ms. Reiner.
Chairperson, thank you, and good morning to those that we've not already greeted, and thank you for the opportunity to deal with an issue that is complex and critically important for us in terms of our ability to deliver on our mandate. I wanted to just introduce the acting CDC development and care, who's just taken a comfort break. Ms. Ntabela is our acting CDC development and care. Ms. Moodley, who holds that post, has been at the United Nations Crime Prevention Conference in Brazil, only arrived back later today. And our director of healthcare services has gone into hospital. She's the subject to health practitioners today. She's having a back up, so apologies from her that she is not here. But that is the team between the three of them that will really be able to take forward the work with the Department of Health going forward. If we could get the presentation up, but I'm presuming that it has also been provided to people in hard copy. We had presented to the Portfolio Committee in the middle of November last year, but in the context, I think, of our presentation of a quarterly report, and the feeling then was that we needed to allow ourselves time to be able to engage on health issues. We had recirculated that presentation, which provides background, last week, so I'm not going to be speaking to that. I'm going to be trying to pick up on where we are now and how we intend to go forward to be able to look at the issue of the provision of healthcare services within our facilities, and bearing in mind that this does need to take on board the issues of healthcare services to remand detainees and healthcare services to sentenced offenders. And there are obviously slightly different dynamics in relation to those. I think our main concern, and this is certainly something that we have discussed with health, and we have made a firm commitment to a partnership going forward to be able to resolve these issues. These are issues that are not issues that have emerged yesterday. They're issues that we've been engaging with, that we've been dealing with as a department for as long as I've been in the department. We have tended to have a stop-start process of resolving them as personnel change on our side or personnel change on the Department of Health side. We've made a firm commitment that this time we are actually going to see it through to its conclusion. And in that sense, DCS is going to be the driver of the joint process that comes out of this process. If I can move to the next slide, the elements that were touched on in the last presentation, just as a very brief reminder, is that the impact of legislation on us as DCS is one of the elements that we really need to look at. We are a national competency. We are bound by the Correctional Services Act. The health process is a different competency. You've got provincial dynamics there that are of profoundly different. The alignment of those processes and the ensuring of consistency both between the legislation and the health environment and our legislation, as well as in addressing the provincial issues, is an important element. I think that the legislative changes post-94 have left us with some gaps that we've identified going forward. The second leg, obviously, is the actual delivery of programs and services to our inmates, which is the key problem that we are concerned with. The health human resources is an issue that we've flagged for the Portfolio Committee, I think, in every single meeting that we've been there. It's an area of acute scarce skills, be it the pharmacists, be it the medical doctors, the nurses, yes, but less so than it used to be, and I think that the OSD in standardising levels of nursing salary levels has gone some way to prevent the drains that we had at a certain point in time in relation to that. The shortages in relation to the psychologists and our complete absence of psychiatrists is also another element that feeds into that. The infrastructural issues, the capacity of our centres to be able to provide healthcare is an important element of the work that we're concerned about. The target population, the difference between health in a remand detention environment, health in a correctional centre environment, but also within that target population, you've got particular health dynamics, be it the issues of communicable diseases, the issues of HIV and AIDS, the issues of diabetes, a whole range of issues that people come in with. The health profile of our inmates takes the health profile of the South African population in. So we need to have a clear understanding of those elements. The health information system is also a particularly important part of what we're concerned about, because we want to be able to ensure that there is no disjuncture in the health information that is available about Jenny when she's sitting at home in Joburg or Pretoria, wherever I'm living at this point in time, and my health information when I'm sitting in a remand detention facility or correctional centre, and when I'm released on parole and when I finish my sentence. And then the last leg, obviously, that we've also reflected on as we've interacted with the portfolio committees, the issues around the transport of ill patients. We have been interacting with the Department of Health, and I think that it's particularly important for both portfolio committees to know that this presentation is taking place in the context of a commitment to re-establish or to establish a task team headed by DCS but involving the Department of Health and the Department of Defence, their medical health services, the SAMS component, as well as National Treasury, because obviously resolving this issue does have financial implications, and we need to ensure that we are take the Treasury on board as a partner in helping us to deal with it, rather than waiting until we've got to a final conclusion and then going to Treasury at the end of the processes. The basis of the discussion that we've had has been on the basis of the kinds of concerns that we have identified. From our perspective as DCS, ensuring the provision of healthcare services to inmates is a critical responsibility. The issue of trying to ensure, in line with international instruments that speak not only to the general process of ensuring continuity of government services to people in incarceration, but specifically in relation to health, that there is there are international instruments that require a continuity of service of government health services, so that there is no disjuncture in terms of the provision of those services. Obviously, there are many ways to skin that cat, and I think that that's in essence what we are dealing with, is how do we ensure that effective health services are provided to the inmates. The staffing issues I've already dealt with. The issue of medication is an important element of this process. Also, we have serious challenges in being able to recruit and retain pharmacists. Where you don't have a pharmacist, you can't manage a pharmacy. In terms of the law, there are very strict controls and very correct controls in relation to that. How then do we access the medication that is required for our inmates in our facilities? That is a critical area. It's also an area that has been subjected to corruption fraud investigations, because it is also an industry that is subject to a whole lot of fraudulent processes, and we need to ensure that we protect ourselves against that. There obviously also are the enormous risks of expired medication and being able to ensure that we don't render our inmates vulnerable to being given expired medicines. The issue of communicable diseases is also one of the elements that has come up in our interaction, come up recently, particularly in Gauteng and I think in LMN, around the outbreak of measles, a partnership that has developed in practice there with the provincial health department that has really enabled us to contain an outbreak of measles last year in Joburg and then later in Boksburg and in a couple of centres in Barberton. But there's a partnership there that is critically important in terms of being able to manage those. And it's an area that we're flagging as requiring a partnership going forward. The TB screening would be another element under that. If I can then talk to the slides very briefly, Chairperson, recognizing that we want to be able to engage rather than to listen to an endless unpacking of health issues. The legislation issues I think I've already spoken to. There is the one clarity on the role of the provinces and trying to ensure that we are able to access consistency from provincial health departments the services that are required. We currently have situations in which there are differences between the different provinces in certain respects. The relationship between the Transformation of Health Services White Paper, the National Health Act, and our own Act is an issue that needs to go forward. And the direction that we are certainly thinking is that the Correctional Services Act wording needs to be clarified. It currently says provide healthcare services. Our interpretation is that our obligation is to ensure the provision of healthcare services. and that we need to then look at what are the mechanisms, the most appropriate mechanisms for being able to do that. We have raised with health and got a commitment that DCS will be able to participate in certain identified health structures. The technical committee of the National Health Committee, if I've got the correct terminology, is a critical step forward for us, and being able to ensure that is not a once-off process but a sustained process is certainly something that we welcome enormously from the Department of Health, because that is the forum in which some of the practical day-to-day and immediate issues will able to be looked at. We've also made a commitment to give to the Department of Health per province a list of the critical issues per province, because they do vary. Gauteng is predominantly an urban-based and well-resourced, relatively well-resourced from a health perspective province. If you're talking about Ngwavuma, it's in the sticks, and you've got a whole set of different circumstances around that. So we need to be able to look at the specifics per province. We're able to recruit medical personnel, health professionals in Gauteng in a way that we can't in rural areas. How then do we partner differently in those areas? So representation within appropriate structures, be it at the national level or in the district health processes, is going to be an important aspect. The formalizing of the incorporation of the Department of Health facilities, the link between district health processes and our health facilities is very important. Part of what we've picked up on is that at times we have frustrated Department of Health personnel who, in terms of their responsibilities, need to be able to access our facilities, but we've not had the necessary protocols in place, and our own personnel have then said this is a DCS environment, not a health environment. So we will need to ensure that the necessary communication is put in place to ensure that there can never be a misinterpretation that disease controller, if again I've got the correct terminology, who needs to be able to go into our facilities in order to perform their functions in terms of the district health system, indeed is able to do so and encouraged and facilitated. So we've committed ourselves to addressing that. That will not only ensure that we can engage on policy and procedure processes, but because the health personnel will have a better understanding of what we're doing in our environment, be able to advise us, but it, most importantly, it relates to the management of diseases within our environment and the training and the mentoring of our personnel. We have already got processes in place in which nurses are being trained in the Department of Health processes. For us, it's an aspect that needs to be enriched going forward. There are issues around the reporting structure that for us are also critically important. We are not a Department of Health. We do have healthcare professionals within our department. They are part of the management system of a correctional centre. Ultimately, they report up to a coordinator of development and care, and then through that to the head of centre. Those are not necessarily health professionals, and there is a critical element of supervision by our health care practitioners, by health personnel, that for us would really add value. And for us, there's an element, and this is particularly where it relates both to our previous discussion this morning and to our discussion last week, and for the purposes of the Health Portfolio Committee, we were discussing last week the issue of rape within our facilities and how we ensure that we are able to address those aspects. The independence of health professionals, in the sense that they have the space that they do not become institutionalized, that they are able to maintain a professional conduct within our environment and not be tainted by elements of abuse within our own system, is for us a very important check and balance. It's an important check and balance in terms of rape that does take place within our facilities, issues of medical examination and the transgender or the gender identity issues that we were talking about earlier this morning, the issues of assaults that have taken place within our facilities, the transfer of people who've been subjected to those two external institutions with correct medical information going forward. There are particular patients or particular diseases that we are really concerned that we need to look at mechanisms to improve them. The one is where we have people admitted to our facilities who are already mental health care users. How do we ensure that when Jenny is admitted, the fact that she has been attending a provincial hospital and is on the following medication is not simply dependent on me, Jenny, saying, by the way, if you don't give me my medicine for schizophrenia, Okay, so it's a question of I'm using an extreme case, but it's an important element of ensuring that there is that element of continuity in terms of the medical information, the health information that comes through. But there are also then two categories of inmates that get admitted into our facilities. The one is people who, in the course of a remand detention, in the course of a court process, are referred to correctional services waiting admission to a mental health institution for purposes of observation. That relates to the capacity of the health, mental health institutions to be able to take those people in, do the necessary observation, and get them back into the court processes. It is an area in which I'm sure both on health side and our side we're concerned about. It's an unnecessarily long process. It's a process that should really be able to move more smoothly. We have identified that one of the mechanisms that would enable us to assist in driving that process would be for the warrant that comes from court to clearly identify on that warrant, so it becomes part of the admission process that we spent the morning talking about, that identifies this is a person who is here for mental health observation purposes. Currently, that is not blatantly obvious on the warrant, and it therefore is something that can get lost in the process. So there are elements there that we need to be able to look at. There are also then people who have been through the court process, have been sentenced, are referred to us as a step on the way to them then serving their sentence within a mental health institution. And again, it's the process in which one wants the time period. Ideally, they should be referred directly from court. If they have to be in our facilities, one, their status needs to be very clear because there are medical, there are accommodation issues that need to be addressed in relation to that. But the time period that they are then accommodated within our facility should really be kept to a minimum level. Apart from that, there are then obviously issues in which we've got the MDR, XDR, TB issues and how we manage those. That it certainly puts an enormous stress on our environment in terms of being able to isolate that category of inmates within our facilities. And then obviously the issues of the communicable diseases that comes up as a critical element of admission of identified patients. The service level agreements relate back to the issue of the provincial competencies. So I'm not going to speak to that in more detail, but it is an important element that we would want to manage going forward. The referral system is an issue that we're concerned about. We do not necessarily have systems in place to ensure that the information that we get when somebody is admitted, the health information comes with them. But the issues then of being able to ensure that where we need to refer people to appropriate higher levels of care than we are able to deliver within our facilities, those mechanisms are in place, including relationships with National Health Laboratory Services. The payment in relation to medication is a critical element. It's divergent between different provinces. It's an issue that obviously is quite a significant burden on the budget of whichever department ultimately is responsible for it. But I think our biggest challenge is a need for us to have that tied down so that we know very clearly this is where the responsibility lies, and therefore the budget in relation to that goes to that particular component. Linked to that, obviously, is the issue of the payment of tariffs in relation to that. The implementation of primary health care within our facilities, the issue that we want to flag there is the importance of a partnership around the guidelines for licensing of primary health care nurses within our facilities. The provision of support programs, I've already spoken on the TB issues and the medication issues, particularly the acute medication, and in particular those areas where we simply don't have pharmacies working within our facilities. The health information system is very important. The continuity of the treatment program of any individual is critically important, that it shouldn't be interrupted. So health information system needs to feed into ours, and equally ours on release needs to feed back into the health processes. And that obviously in terms of remand detention poses particular challenges. Chairperson, I hope I'm within your time limit. In the way forward, we have established a task team. We have, and it consists of correctional services that will convene it so that we can ensure that we sustain the process We've got the Department of Health on board, and we've got Military Services on board. And what we've not reflected on the slide, and I apologize for it, I think it's reflected on the opening slide, we intend to ensure that Treasury is part of that process so that they can assist us going forward. That process will audit the current health status of our services and identify the challenges per province. So it's a process of pulling together a lot of information that we already do know, but also, and the audit is certainly not going to be travelling to 241 centres and looking at exactly what exists in each centre. It would rather be determining the different scenarios within different facilities. I've already indicated the difference between remand detention and a correctional centre. There's a difference between a centre which has got 3,000 people and a centre which has got 60 people. Difference between a centre which is in the deep rural areas and a centre that is slap bang in the middle of a urban environment, a metropolitan environment. Difference between a management area which is all located on one terrain in Joburg and a management area as SADA management area in the Eastern Cape, in which you've got centres scattered over a vast geographic area. So even if one can put health professionals at a management area level in Joburg, that is something that adds value. In SADA, you've got people then having to spend inordinate amounts of time on the road. Obviously, that also then feeds into the issues of rationalising our centres that we've spoken to the Portfolio Committee about, and this may be one of the elements in which part of the recommendations relate to our ability to provide those services. We can just go back to the previous slide. In essence, the various categories of what I've spoken to now are what we have said to the Department of Health should form the terms of reference of that task team. Along with the feasibility study that had been done in the Department on Pharmaceutical Services. That and the recommendations from the Health Roundtable and the issues that we've identified here and any of the issues from the Department of Health side that they want to reflect back to us about where we should be or could be doing things differently would form the terms of reference. Our intention is to look at both issues that can be attended to in the immediate sense, so that we're able to identify pharmaceutical services now at Centre X we can attend to by SAMHS providing that function. Health services at Centre Y we can attend to in the following way, but also looking at the medium to long-term processes. And we've identified four options that we would be interrogating through this process to look at how best to ensure the provision of healthcare services to both remand detainees and offenders and correctional centres. The first is whether the current system that we have in DCS, the current healthcare system, can be strengthened through support from the Department of Health, and if so, how to do that. The second would be that the provision of healthcare services in our correctional facilities and our remand detention facilities should in fact be a Department of Health responsibility, and then if so, how do we migrate to that process. The third option would be that South African Military Health Services could be contracted by DCS to render healthcare services in particular places, not necessarily all over. Part of the question that they have reflected back to us is can we provide a GIS map of exactly where health services are required, what health services are required. So, again, that would be part of the terms of reference of it. And the fourth element, obviously, is the contracting the delivery of healthcare services to the private sector. Those are the four options in very broad terms that we have mapped out. Our intention is to get that task team to work intensively in order to be able to raise up issues that can then be fed into either the technical committee of the National Health Committee or into service level agreements between the provincial health departments and DCS regions or addressed through partnerships with SAMHS. But at the same time then to generate a CAB memo that would go through to Cabinet to deal with the issue of those four options or as many other options as emerge out of the process with a recommendation to Cabinet as to the long-term solution to the process so that we don't land up where consistently we are saying this is what we should be doing and we're unable to do it for the following processes. Chairperson, I hope that I've kind of taken you from where we were with the Health Roundtable, the presentation in November, the interaction that we've got, mapping a way forward. We intend to have draft terms of reference as a department finalised within the next 2 weeks so that we can convene that task team. We would then want those terms of reference signed off by health, by ourselves and by SAMHS so there's a commitment from all of us at stage one. We would also want within the month of May and as early as possible in May to have a project plan, so that we are quite clear of what our time frames are and what the deliverables are at each point in time, which would enable us to ensure that the process doesn't slide off the agenda, but that we are also able to be held accountable in terms of delivery on that process. What we are hoping, Chairperson, is that the engagement today from both portfolio committees and from both departments will enable us to enrich those terms of reference to really be able to find permanent and sustainable solutions. Thank you.
DG Health, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes, thank you. Firstly, thanks very much for the invitation to this committee. And good morning to the chairperson and members of the Portfolio Committee on Health as well. Just a few things to reinforce. The commissioner actually speaks like a true health professional, so there's not much substance to add to what you said. It accurately describes the engagement we've had and the agreements we've reached between our two departments. But just to reinforce a few things. Firstly, I think there are some immediate and short-term things we need to do, those revolve around the list of challenges in each province, the review and possibly revision of the service level agreements that currently are in existence. And the third, which is very critical, which I think I need to speak to, is any new prison must take into consideration infection control and especially airborne infection control. Many of our facilities, and I must add, these include health facilities too, especially the old ones, are not geared up to prevent the spread of airborne infection control. So TB, for example, unless you manage it very effectively, can be spread very rapidly. The same, for example, measles. So our plea would be, and that's a short-term thing with the new facilities that we are planning. Then there are medium-term issues that I think the Commissioner spoke to in terms of the four options. It's also possible that there's a fifth option, which is a mix of those options, and that might be easiest to effect immediately because it's possible that one size may not fit all and that we might need to have some degree of variability or flexibility, acknowledging that flexibility is always difficult to manage, especially in a centralized, in a highly centralized system. Such as in correctional services. Chair, we do have some precedents for a transfer of functions, and the one that comes to mind immediately is the transfer of forensic services, including the mortuaries, from SAPS to HELP. But it was not an easy process. It was quite a long and lengthy process. So if we go that route, we must accept that it might take some while before a fairly comprehensive forensic audit is done on what the state of the facilities are, who is being transferred, what the costs are, and it, as the Commissioner said, it needs the participation of Treasury to effect. Finally, Chair, it seems like whether they are immediate, short-term, or medium-term, the interventions really are at three levels. The first is the system level, and I think the Commissioner outlined all of those issues that relate to systems. The second is human resources. And the human resources issues also relate to issues around stigma, unfortunately. And the final is finance. I think it's well known that all government departments are stressed in terms of financial resources, and that any shifts or any improvement in services actually is going to require some quantum of efficiency gains for sure, but also additional resources. I do think that there's a goodwill and willingness from the Department of Health to work closely with the Department of Correctional Services to fix this problem. Having said that, we've been engaged with the Department of Correctional Services over the last 15 years, certainly for as long as I've been in the department, with variable success. And I think the participation of both committees would really help to spur us on in terms of getting some quick wins, so that we do, in fact, improve not only the health of offenders, but also the health of people outside prisons, because it's almost a seamless relationship between correctional services and the wider community, both with respect to people working in correctional facilities and also offenders upon their release. I think I'll stop there, Chair. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. We'll open up for engagement. But I wanted to, certainly to our members, one of our members of DCS and also to Jenny. You know, from the experience from our immediate the meeting before this one, I do think that we're going to have to change the way we do oversight. That will allow members to give us experiences from their constituencies, as opposed to the theory that we're getting from the department. Because the theory makes lots of sense. And yet what we feel on the ground as public representatives doesn't bear out with the theory. So I'm looking at members. We're having a engagement with the department. Our next engagement with the department is on education. I really do think we're going to start by asking members to tell us what is happening in South Africa around education in prisons, and the department's briefing notes will then be their speaking notes in responding to it. Otherwise, I don't think we are being very effective as oversight practitioners. And it's not a reflection on the departments at all. I'm just saying if we want to be serious about our business, we need to do it differently. So I'm grateful for the theory. It assists on the theory from my side. I would imagine DG Health and DCS that when you get to the point of finalizing your service level agreement, that at least we have sight of it. I know that it's not our responsibility to manage that government, and ours is to oversee, but we might have some comments around these things. For instance, I mean, just off the top of my head, I hear you saying that there's been takeovers. There might be practical difficulties if health in prisons is the domain of the Department of Health. Who pays for the budget? When I come and fight about a prisoner dying, then I'm told that, well, don't talk to me, talk to the DG of Health. So I'm saying there might just be practical difficulties around those type of things. And all I would want to say is that I think we can wait for the, and members can speak, I'm not speaking for members, but from my side, we'd wait for that service level agreement, but if we could just have sight of it to engage with it. And then the issues that you've raised, I think, are important. Who pays for the medication, measles inoculations, the ARVs? It's been problems all along, the retention of pharmacies and expired medications in all our facilities. Issues that always come up, and then the point that you raised about the profile of provinces, Gauteng might be totally different to KZN. So those are important things. But I wanted to raise just two issues that I thought this engagement was going to be about from our side, and members would raise them. The first one that I'd like to raise is, you know, I certainly on a regular basis ask the secretary to get the number of deaths in prison for me. And we ask the department to give us those deaths in prisons by category, natural and unnatural. I think I could confidently say that in all of them that I get, there's probably 70% to 80% natural deaths and 20% unnatural deaths. This is what the department says to me. However, the question that I'm asking, and then this raises, or this goes back to what you gave us earlier on, Commissioner, that at admission, within 24 hours, I need a medical check. Now, if that is happening within 24 hours of admission, and 2 months later, Vincent dies of natural death, there's got to be a problem. There's got to be a problem. It's either that that's not a natural death, and we are being told it's a natural death, when it's an unnatural death in there, or people are not examining Vincent when he comes into to the cells. We can't all get heart attacks, and there are those where I'd be healthy today and die tomorrow. So for me personally, DG Health, DG Correctional Services, and the Health Committee, there are far too many unnatural deaths in our prison, or natural deaths in our prison, that worry me. Around, and this is not old age, by the way. You know, people that die of old age is something else. But perfectly healthy Vincent goes to prison, that 2 months later or a year later he's dead, and we're told that it's a natural death. So this is what we pick up in our constituency, and I'm saying we need to talk about how do we either do correct oversight or implement systems that help us with that one. The second issue, and again I'm talking from my own constituency, and I think you alluded to it in your slides, Ms. Reiner, and I think this doesn't only happen in Johannesburg, I think Eastern Cape, I picked it up at some point. You know, communities are unable to understand why when prisoner X must be sent out, I don't know if it still happens now, because you do in Berra, but very many would go to Garden City Clinic in Johannesburg. You know, Garden City Clinic, many of my constituency in Westbury can't access because it's a private clinic. Many of my constituency in Rivoli, New Clare, can't access it because it's a private clinic. But you go there and you have inmates that are sitting in that prison or lying in that prison, and my constituency can't understand it. I know some go to Berra, which is fine, where we all go to, and that's where we'd expect. But right alongside Garden City, there's a Helen Joseph State Hospital. And I think the argument that these hospitals don't have security, sufficient security, can't hold anymore. It can't hold anymore. When I ask the questions or when I try and justify it, I say, because those, you are able to keep these guys in detention or under police guard. I just think communities are no longer buying that argument. So is there a way of us fixing it up? Because maybe not communities only. I also have difficulty with somebody going to a private health care. And my mother that lives down the road in Newcastle had to go to Helen Joseph. So those are the two issues that I just thought I wanted to raise from my side about the practical difficulties that we have there. I'll open it up to members, if there are any members that would want to raise these issues, so that you factor that into your service level agreement for future ones. But I'm opening it up to members for any engagement. If not, I'll ask them to respond to those. Everybody's welcome, by the way, even our comrades and colleagues from health. We'll take Mr. Fritz as the first one, and then Mam Nyanda as the second person, and then we might ask the department to respond. Mr. Fritz.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'm quite interested with the different models that was presented to us for possible operational purposes in prisons, in correctional centers. And I want to address two of the kind of, and I'll come to why I think we perhaps should look at one of the models, and I think a fifth model that the DG just raised. I know in the Western Cape the last time when I looked at the number of people awaiting observations in mental institutions, and specifically Falkenberg, I think the total was 166. And I know of the 166, priority was given to children, detainees, who must be observed to determine whether they were fit to stand trial and all that. So what happens in the meantime, and I had a specific case a few years ago, Dr. Tladi, who hit a professor at UCT with umbrella, who waited for a very long time in Baltimore, subject to massive abuse, and eventually he was pathologically declared not fit and he's in an institution. I'm just saying, you know, I think a lot of people get mentally ill from being in prison. That I honestly think so. And it may not be very scientific, but and I think that was a case in point for me. So I'm saying perhaps we should really look, and one of the reasons why I would support a model where the Department of Health takes over the kind of medical care in prisons, in correctional centers, is that you would have this continuous treatment, which is given outside will be kind of inside. I think doctors are already appointed by the Department of Health in correctional centers. And I think nurses, my argument for nurses being, I've seen also how nurses become, and a word I don't want to use it too much, but how they become so institutionalized that they have lost their professionalism as nurses. That's one should keep that Department of Health kind of ethics in and not let them wear that brown uniform with red kind of lapel or whatever you call the bullet. That's the first point. I think, as the DG indicated, perhaps the immediate thing that can be done if that doesn't work, perhaps to look at a PPP model that you use, but again, within constraints of cost. And I really think one should go and really professionalize without prejudicing our communities in terms of the levels of healthcare, that our communities can start showing fingers that, you know, you have this excellent treatment inside prison, but it out is a river. I mean, it's pathetic, you are really treated badly. I'm saying those are things that we will grapple with for a while until we come to a proper model that is cost-effective and effective in terms of our community's view, some kind of the notion of being incarcerated. We don't want a situation where a boy says, it's better to be inside because I can get 3 meals and watch TV than outside. I don't think we want that kind of situation, but I think that balance is all the time important. So thanks, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've got a concern. Provinces to review decision that the department should pay for this medication. I'm from Mpumalanga. We are suffering. There are no medicines. You find people standing in the queue from morning till sunset. I wonder where is this department going to get this money from? I was in Barberton Prison. There's one doctor who visits the center once a week, but the total there is above 1,000. And there are no nurses. There are two nurses full-time. I'm talking of juvenile center. When you go down to the maximum, it's worse. There are no doctors. There are no nurses. And if these provinces, my province, Mpumalanga, they are suffering now, I wonder if people budgeted for this payment, for this medication. If yes, I'll be happy. If no, it's a problem. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. We were very grateful that you have invited us. At least this is eye-opening for us from the Portfolio Committee for Health. So thank you. I'm not sure whether you are general now or it's something else, but you are still a commissioner or general. I don't want to say wrong words. I want to say the correct one. Commissioner. Oh, okay. Okay. Thanks, Jürgen. We are all over. You can see that. We will always find that. I think we accept having done some of our constituents work. There are problems in health in the prisons. We don't have to go into detail, but we're very happy that we're invited into a meeting of this nature where somebody has noticed that there are problems and we needed to come together. I'm very happy with what has been said by Jürgen in your summary about human resources and the infection control in those areas. So we think that this is going to help us. But as a portfolio committee, I think we go along with what you are doing and we support it. But I think where we come in is to see how, which one do you think of this, which one do you think is going to suit you better? On one side, we know that my belief, personally, I believe that health, the Department of Health should be handling every health problem in South Africa, be it private, be it public, be it in prison, but the people of South Africa should get good health services from the Department of Health. But knowing the challenges that are in health now, you don't know which is going to be the best one that you are going to be using. And I would be interested so that, and if you want some advice or you want us to give you our sort of thinking, we would do that, would actually make some suggestions. Things like the measles, but I was interested in the measles. I wanted to go further. I know there might be the measles. Is it in adults or is it young kids that are in prison? I'm very interested in that. Even the rapes that are happening there, I'm interested as to what you are doing. In fact, maybe let me put it this way. you know what, you are coming up and you have actually put a deadline that by May, I'm not sure if I'm right, but it seems as if you said by May this must be, but that is very good that we need to have done something by that time. But what is happening now? What is going on as far as infections, as far as the deaths that are happening in prison? So I've got interest even in this bit. But at the same time, when you look at the health professionals, they have not been trained to look after people who are not dangerous, but people who can cause. What would be their security when they go in there and they do the work? There's another one that probably you'll have to answer for me. You know, in the rural areas, places like Kumtata, there used to be district surgeons, which we stopped. There used to be district surgeons, and those district surgeons, it was automatic, that if you're a district surgeon, you work in prison. You do primary health care, you do whatever that needs to be done there. I don't know what is happening. Is that still continuing, and what is going on now? But the last one, I didn't hear medical parole. I know probably that's a can of worms on the other side. But is the medical parole health is supposed to be health professionals that are supposed to be there, or how does it get done? I'm just asking. I'm not opening a can of worms, but I'm just asking. Thank you, sir.
Can we ask the departments to respond in any order? And then we will take a second round. Mdaka, you'll come for a second round later with anybody else.
Chairperson, let me dive in, and I'm sure the DG of Health can then come in, because I certainly am nowhere near a health professional. Obviously, in terms of the particular requests in terms of ongoing interaction around options and SLAs, and we will certainly engage with both the Correctional Services Portfolio Committee and the Department, the Portfolio Committee on Health, in relation to those, because I think that it's going to add an enormous amount of value, and we really do need to ensure that we get to a point where this is a sustainable process going forward. The issues of the categories of deaths, Chairperson, I think that you've hit the nail on the head. It is really alarming when one starts to get the information on deaths, be they unnatural and natural, flowing in. There are obviously people who come into our centres ill, and part of what one would want to be able to improve is our ability to measure those kinds of things. So we're able to determine to what extent is this people who are already entering our centres, already with an illness profile. To what extent is it the very essence of incarceration? I think that Mr. Fitz raised it in relation to people becoming mentally unwell, mentally ill within a correctional centre environment. I want to take that very seriously, because it's true in two senses. The very process of incarcerating a human being disturbs your health. It disturbs your physical health. You're not as active as you normally are in the course of your life. You are under an enormous amount of stress. Your diet is a standardized diet. It's not the diet that you may be used to. There are a whole lot of elements there that impact directly on your health. If you are somebody who is vulnerable in terms of mental health, that process becomes that much more extreme. When one starts talking to psychologists and psychiatrists, and this is where I'm really completely out of my depth in terms of health professionalism, but there are categories of people who can function perfectly well, but put in an environment of incarceration and put in an environment of incarceration with some of the types of personalities that we have in our facilities, are going to become mentally very unwell and in a state in which they need to actually be transferred to a mental health institution. So there are very real issues of health within our environment that is different from outside. There are triggers in our environment that need to be taken on board, and I think that that's part of where the expectations on a health professional who is treating a patient who is an inmate and treating a patient who's at home. You land up with somebody, I'm just going to use somebody with a back problem. You land up with somebody who's in a correctional centre, who's got a history of serious back problems. the way in which you can treat that person in that environment, the way in which you can treat somebody at home. Go and walk on a beach on a daily basis, because your back needs to be physically strong. You need to ensure that you maintain it, but you can't do that in a prison. So there's a different set of treatment or environmental circumstances that need to be taken on board in it. There are obviously then diseases that people are vulnerable to within our environment, and there's a certain category of them that are stress-related, and that you may well never have manifest with diabetes. But under those particular circumstances, it's something that comes to the fore. There are also then obviously the communicable diseases, and that is a critical element of the partnership between us and health on those issues in particular. The measles process in Joburg, it started from remand detainees coming in from the community, came in with measles into the remand detention facility, because in the remand detention facility we had offenders who then work on in particular functions within the remand detention facility. There was a risk then that it would spread from the remand detention facility to the correctional center. We contained it by preventing those people from going back to that center and having a section in which they were accommodated. But there we were dealing with adults. We do have, obviously, the babies that are incarcerated with their mothers, and I think that the vaccination program that we've been involved in with the Department of Health has particularly targeted the babies that are incarcerated, the children that are in our facilities, and then spreading to the broader population. On the issue of the private institutions, Chairperson, it is a critical issue, and I do want to emphasize that our policy is very clearly that inmates, be they remand detainees or sentenced offenders, go to state institutions unless they choose at their own expense to go to a private institution. The only circumstances in which we would refer somebody to a private institution is where the quality of treatment that they require requires professional services or technology or whatever that is not available at that particular the state institution, and therefore they need to be accommodated in a private institution. But the policy is that they go to provincial state hospitals. Historically, that was not the case, but we went through a process in 2002-03 of making it very clear that short of there being medical reasons why that person cannot be treated at a provincial hospital, at a state hospital, that they will go to the state hospitals, and this is at their own expense. I think the issue of the role of the district surgeons is perhaps something that is something worth looking at, because that indeed is implicit in the situation that we've gotten. Historically, the district surgeons provided the doctors' expertise into our facilities. The department had nurses employed on the staff, but the district surgeons came into our facilities, whether they were rural or urban, and that process was managed through that process. With the change in 94, the district surgeon system, we then went for the process of trying, as the department, to procure, recruit and retain the services of the medical doctors, and that is a particular challenge, to be able to sustain that capacity. The previous system of ensuring that the district surgeon system provided those was better able to ensure that those services were available across the board. So the interaction on the models, I think, is a critically important part, and it may well be that elements of the fifth model, certainly as a short-term solution, would be the route to go, and we would certainly appreciate the interaction with the both portfolio committees in relation to that. Our own approach as a department is that increasingly, because of the challenges that we've experienced in providing healthcare services, is that indeed the option that would be desired is that health actually has that full mandate. The issues of security of health personnel when they are in our facilities is a critical one, but the district surgeon model provided for that. There is a process of ensuring that we accompany. We have a range of service providers coming into our facilities from community-based organizations, NGOs. So there are mechanisms in place for the security of those personnel to be attended to. And we, those would obviously be part of the options going forward to ensure that we do not render people vulnerable in that situation and hence land up where people are reluctant to take up those responsibilities. Yeah, on the last issue is the issue of medical parole. It's a critically important part of the process. We have currently, in terms of our law, a policy that enables us to give medical parole only to that category of people who are terminally ill. We are in the process of developing a medical parole policy that it will enable us to give medical parole to people who are not only at the terminally ill stage, but whose incarceration is inappropriate given their medical status. So there is currently a process of working on that. That will probably require amendment of our legislation, given that our law defines the policy to relate to terminally ill, but it does raise very serious questions around the decision-making in terms of parole lies at the parole board level or at the National Council level as a recommendation ultimately to the Minister. Although we do have on a National Council medical health professionals, the parole boards are not constituted with medical personnel. So the importance of medical of health professionals' reports on medical parole issues becomes critically important. And that is an issue that, as part of the medical parole process, we need to look at. So that we can also be sure that we have people who are independent of... We have an increasing process of inmates in relation, for example, in relation to LIFR's parole processes, leaving aside the issue of medical parole, people going to get psychiatric assessments done at their own expense by their own psychologists or their own psychiatrists that is then presented as part of motivating that a particular inmate will not recommit crime. Right. Now, we need to be able to be sure that that is not somebody who is being paid by Jenny to say Jenny won't commit crime, but that in fact that is an independent assessment and an independent assessment by somebody who has the necessary expertise to draw the conclusion about my psychological state and my propensity to commit crime. So there are critical health professional issues around the issues of rehabilitation, psychological assessment, and in particular the medical parole issue. So part of the medical parole policy issue is an engagement with health professionals. We had an engagement, I think, now 2 months ago, although my sense of time is getting really stretched, but recently around medical parole, in which we were looking at what are the best mechanisms for being able to ensure that when a parole board is faced with a recommendation for medical parole, they can confidently say, this is a genuine medical parole case, and this is not Jenny paid somebody to get a medical parole recommendation. Chairperson, I think that I've touched on them, but maybe DJ Health wants to pick up on it.
Thanks. I'll be brief, and with your permission, leave after I comment on it, because as I said, I've got another meeting to chair. On the issue of large numbers of natural deaths in prisons, I guess the one issue, Chair, is if you imagine that many of a fair number of our offenders have chronic diseases, including HIV, and if we are not treating them very well while they're in prison, then it's likely that they will die from those causes. So we'll need to figure out together with the Department of Correctional Services on what screening is done on admission and whether or not that screening is comprehensive to take into consideration, especially the chronic diseases. But that goes together with the provision of good quality of care while offenders are incarcerated. I think on that issue, we can have a reasonably quickly drafted checklist that the head of the prison could use to evaluate their own services. Because I would imagine that, like we are starting to hold CEOs of hospitals more accountable for the service they run, we should also do that with the head of the prison. Not on things that are outside their control, like hiring staff, you know, which is difficult, but even things in their control. For example, we know that there are what are called administrative controls that can improve infection control measures, like keeping the windows open. So, you know, the prison staff then should ensure that windows are kept open as far as possible to improve infection control measures. So there are simple things like that, you know, that I think we can work together with the department to improve. The issue of district surgeons, Chairperson, we in health, as the Commissioner mentioned, did away with district surgeons soon after democracy, largely because the system was being abused massively and with poor controls over district surgeons. And we replaced that with sessional doctors. Now, you might agree that we created a problem by trying to solve one problem. We created another problem. But that's why we need to look on a case-by-case basis at the SLAs. So the issue of Mpumalanga not having drugs, for example, we need to look at whether or not the Department of Health is supposed to provide drugs to those prisons, or the correctional services are supposed to be purchasing drugs outside of the national state tender system. I must confess, I don't know the answer to that question, Honourable Member. So we'll have to look at what the problem is in Mpumalanga. I must confess, though, that in Mpumalanga we've also had a problem of lack of drugs in some health facilities. Because towards the end of the financial year, the province just ran out of money to purchase drugs. So it might be related to that problem, which we are trying to fix in a sustainable way going forward, including the possibility of central purchasing of drugs, so that we don't leave it to the vagaries of provincial cash flow problems to determine whether or not we have supplies such as drugs in a particular province. But that's something we're looking at going forward. Chair, I think the observational patients that Honourable Fritz referred to has been an ongoing challenge, partly also because of lack of sufficient beds in our forensic units, including in Falkenberg. But that's a national problem. It's not just in the Western Cape. I guess the bottom line, Chair, is to figure out how to keep people out of prison, you know, as far as it's possible. And if they are in prison, how to keep them as healthy as possible for as long as possible, notwithstanding the environment in which they are, which the Commissioner correctly points out, is a stressful environment. But that's precisely why they are there. So it's a bit of a difficult thing, you know, to provide an environment that's conducive to good health, including good mental health, on the one hand. On the other hand, you want this to be a deterrent to other committing other crimes. I don't know what the balance is. I guess the balance from a human rights perspective is to do the right thing on both sides of the fence. I'm not sure that we've got it right or we have a good idea of how to get it right. But I would, in conclusion, Chair, I would just say that our representative from Health on the task team is Mr. Masilela. And that's why he's here, so that he could hear firsthand from the committees on what guidance you're providing us so that he can participate effectively in the task team. Finally, let me thank you very much for the invitation.
Thank you so much, DG. I had noted Ms. Mdaka. I'm not sure if there's a second round. Dube, I beg your pardon, and then Mr. Abraham, in that order. Ms. Mdaka?
Thank you, Chairperson. I'm a bit concerned and worried, Chairperson, about the options that may be looked at. Is it a person? Is DCS contract SA Military Services to render health care services to offender, to the offenders? Who will pay for this service? Taking into account that 80 million has been reduced from care budget. So, who will pay for this service? Thank you, Chair.
Ms. Ndube.
Chairperson, I also thank the committee for inviting us. At least this is an eye-opening. And to me, it's not just an eye-opening, but it starts to raise concerns. The concern that I want to start with is that one is not negative, but one wants to be a little bit realistic, that all of us knows how health, human resource is a challenge in this country. The same hospitals that we have are having scarce staff. Whilst we appreciate, personally I appreciate that we really need to expand the health service into the correctional service. The first question that I'm asking, when are we going to do it? if we are all saying human resource in health, it's a challenge. The very same hospitals that people must go doesn't have nurses, doctors, blah, blah, blah. It's a good idea, but practically it gives me personally a challenge. Number two is that the kids that are born in these facilities, how long do we keep them in this facility? Do they go to school? Do they have preschool? What is it that we are doing as the country with these kids that are in this facility, whilst they are also, you know, vulnerable to these diseases in this environment? The last question is that I know for a fact that the people go to this other, let me put it this way. I was one of the people who was in prison at some stage. With my chronic asthma, it became a problem. You'll go to a doctor outside the facility, they'll give you medication, but when you come back, you must leave the medication somewhere. Has that process changed? Because you can die with your medication in that prison, with, whereby somebody won't provide the medication as and when you want it. So has the system improved or changed in that regard? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, firstly, I want to thank the Commissioner for the presentation. And I have a direct question. The babies that are incarcerated with their mothers, I understand that they are allowed to be there up to the age of 2 years. Now, if that baby becomes seriously ill and requires, for argument's sake, surgery, which is an expensive procedure, who will be responsible for taking the tab? Now, Chair, with regard to the presentation itself, in consequence of the meeting of the 18th of November, where the portfolio committee requested that these issues be addressed, I have a major problem, Chair. My problem is that in the introduction, it's quite clear here, yeah? Several presentations were made to the different parliamentary structures in the past years, and the challenges still remain the same. Now, that's a problem, Chair. Secondly, several meetings have been held with the Department of Health at various levels. I take it even at provincial levels, and National Treasury, to try and resolve these issues, to try and resolve them. The question that begs, Chair, is that in all these years of several representations, in all these years of several meetings being held with the national department, and Mr. Masilela must take note, which is responsible for the overall health of the total population, which includes, to my mind, also those that are incarcerated, through its various agencies, the various provincial health departments. And we are still trying to resolve the issues. The question that begs, Chair, is how serious are these departments? How serious is Treasury in trying to help us to address issues? Where is the lack of the will? Is it administrative will? Somewhere it is said here that political will also is required. Then, Chair, we've got to address those sectors where the will is lacking. Because, Chair, we cannot continuously live on a time bomb. These things can explode in our faces. And my problem, Chair, and I'm sure the committees, is this frustration that year in and year out we talk about things. I don't know where the bottlenecks are, where it gets constipated, and nothing happens. And say it is time that we be told, and this is my question to the acting commissioner, and I'm sure she will not have all the information now. I would love to have a diary of all their meetings, all their engagements in having tried to do these things, so that we can then tackle these things at a political level and see that there is some political will to try and help resolve it. Now, Chair, I've said this before, but for the benefit of Mr. Masilela, I believe that the Correctional Services' basic mandate is to see that it provides shelter to the inmates that are entrusted to them. It is to see that they are well clothed, that they are well fed, and naturally that they are well looked after. That is the basic mandate. Now, Chair, I would also like to know, to what degree are the provincial health departments coming to the party? Or are we merely looking at the national department and not engaging the provincial department? Because the centres, Chair, although they are controlled by a national department, they are placed in various provinces. And they are supposed to be health services close to those various centres. In the majority of instances, I know that there are, I wouldn't say any illness is minor, but there are clinics and there are provincial hospitals. To what extent are we getting assistance from the provincial departments? Because this sort of business as usual, Chair, cannot carry on. We have to see our people, face them, and we have to have answers. And we need to see that a resolution comes, Chair. We cannot again have a presentation one day where we are told that several representations are made to try and resolve the issue, and it does not happen. Thank you, Chair.
Anybody else wants to respond? Otherwise, we'll ask the department to close for us when they respond. Any other new questions? No? Okay, can we hand over to Ms. Schreiner and Mr. Masilela if you want to respond to any of these?
Chairperson, the issue of the contracting of SANS and the issue of the budget, that's precisely why we have said in terms of the task team that we need to ensure the Treasury is on board, so that we are able to say if this is a service that can be provided on a SANS budget, so be it. If this is a budget, a service that is provided on our expense, so be it. But those are issues that need to be interrogated in detail by this task team, and those will certainly be a critical element of the work going forward. We do not want to land up in a situation in which we take decisions that we will get SANS to do this, and then we land up where down the line budget issues come to hit us on the back of the head. So that's a critical element of it, is to be able to look, and in some senses, as we are looking at those options, both as immediate options and as longer-term options, the costing of those options becomes a critical part of it, because as was indicated by the DG of Health, all government departments have got strapped cash situations. We need to ensure that we are best able to find solutions, cut them to the cloth, and not be able to have pipe dreams that won't realize. So we will take that on board and ensure that it is looked at. Part of what SANS had reflected to us in our interaction with them was that they also need to be able to determine where we need the services delivered, because they may not be able to deliver the services at the places that we need to be able to deal with it. So there's a lot of detailed work that needs to be done there to address those issues, both if it's a short-term process as well as the medium-term process. The issue of the HR concerns is obviously, I mean, it's a critical issue that cuts across both our facilities and the health services. And again, those are critical issues that we need to be able to look at. One of the issues, for example, that was raised at our recent African Corrections Association meeting was that, they, for example, in Nigeria, they have an extraordinarily high, in comparison to us, high level of health professionals. To what extent are there issues that we can address in relation to partnerships in that sense? And that may be another element that needs to be looked at in terms of the human resourcing dimension of the solutions to these problems. What I think for me is important to hear from the chairperson of the Portfolio Committee on Health is that if the task team does not attend to detail, we are going to land up with solutions that in reality can't address. So I think that is an aspect going forward. In relation to the children born in our facilities, I think Mr. Adams has already indicated the policy says that they can be there for 2 years. Our desire is that they are there for long enough to be able to bond with their mother and be able to be safe and secure. The vulnerability, obviously, to diseases within that environment is a critical risk that one doesn't want them to be exposed to. The policy basically says as soon as it's in the best interest of the child to leave, even under the 2 years, that is the route that should go. But the management of disease in relation to those children is a critical aspect. I'm going to ask Ms. Ntabela to speak on the issue of the access to medication because it has, in fact, changed somewhat from the previous situation, but just to flag as well that there are serious risks that we have to manage of the abuse of medication within our facilities. And in that sense, very strict control over where medication is an important aspect. Chip, if I can ask Ms. Ntabela and then come back to the final issues raised by Ms. Davis.
Thank you for the opportunity. I think the system you're referring to, the old system of Pele Parare, we no longer have people that have to chew to say I have a headache or it's my turn to get medication. For those that are asthmatic, they do keep their pumps with them. We know that you cannot die from pumping yourself either out of overdose or anything like that. The only time that we keep the medication in the hospital section is where we have identified that the patient may be a risk to himself by having so many medication with him. I can use that for committing suicide or anything like that. But the Pele Parare has stopped.
Chairperson, to pick up then on the real concern, which I'm sure is a concern that everybody in this room has. Precisely because of the concerns that Mr. Abrams has been raising, that we've had this process that we've repeatedly been saying we're not finding the solution, and rather than being able to find solutions that improve, we land up where we continue to have a situation in which we know we are unable to provide healthcare services, is why we have landed up interacting with the Department of Health to commit to a task team that is going to take a process through to cabinet level. Because we are, the approach that we've had is that we've had endless processes to try and tweak the system. And that tweaking the system may find an immediate solution for a limited period of time, but it doesn't fundamentally address the underlying problems, some of which are generic underlying problems of the delivery of health in South Africa. And we will need to ensure that as the health system of South Africa matures equally, so does our correctional services health, ensuring that we can provide health. We have taken responsibility as DCS to convene and drive that task team precisely because we want to get out of the process of repeatedly saying we've had meetings and we have not got anywhere. So the terms of reference of that task team are going to be signed off by the DGs of the relevant departments. In addition, there is going to be a very clear project plan with clear deliverables that will enable us to sustain the momentum. If Jenny's not in Jenny's seat tomorrow, the work can continue. And I think that part of what we've experienced is not so much a question of there isn't political will. Part of it is that as much as we have constraints in our environment, the Department of Health has constraints within their environment. But part of it is a change of personnel. So somebody who's a key role player in a task team from the Department of Health side, then, for example, there is a particular person who was employed on contract at one stage. There was very strong interaction during that process. That process then falls to pieces at the stage that that person... So we need to ensure that there's a sustainable process, and we think that this a task team with clear terms of reference with a process that would ultimately take options of a sustainable and permanent solution through to cabinet level will be the right way to go. The issue of whether the provincial health departments are coming to the table. Obviously, our critical challenge is we're a national competency, and we're interacting with 9 different provincial health departments, and the processes in those health departments are not completely uniform. So, and I think that the DG of Health indicated in relation to Mpumalanga that we would need to look at that particular service level agreement with that particular provincial health department to determine what in that province is provided by health and what in that province is provided by correctional services. But I think that the DG of Health has given us the route to start addressing that in a way that we've not been able to before. By us as a department being represented on the technical committee of the National Health Committee, that enables us to have a place to table those types of issues. The process of us being able to provide to the DG of Health a list per province. In Mpumalanga, these are our challenges. In Gauteng, these are our challenges, and they're not going to be the same challenges. But with a commitment from the DG of Health that he will then facilitate bilaterals between DCS, the provincial head of department, and the Department of Health, so that we all get onto the same page. Those processes will be built into that ongoing program of work, and I think in that way we will be able to come back with solutions, but also come back with, here's a particular problem, and let us collectively interrogate our way forward. But from our side and from the interaction that we've had with the Department of Health and from SAM's side, we are firmly committed to getting ourselves out of a process in which we come back and say the problems remain. It's precisely because the solutions that have been found so far have not resulted in sustainable solutions. Our HR situations, although there are certain improvements in relation to it, we're better able to recruit and retain nurses. Our ability to retain the pharmacists is practically non-existent. Our medical personnel is in an incredibly difficult situation. It's precisely those and the financial constraints that are applicable across all departments, but in particular in relation to health, that require us to look at sustainable solutions differently from the way in which we have previously. So I think that we've learned from that process of repeated interactions that we actually need a systemic and holistic approach to dealing with it and dealing with it on those various different levels as the DG of Health has mapped out. Chairperson, I hope that we've done justice to the questions that have been put up.
No, you haven't done justice to the question.
No.
If a baby is sick in hospital and has a...
Yes.
Who carries the care?
We do.
That's the last one.
We do. Chairperson, that's quite clear. Those babies, while they're incarcerated in our facilities, are our responsibility. So in exactly the same way that if an inmate falls ill, it is our responsibility to ensure that they get the treatment that they deserve within our facility. If they then require external treatment, that referral process that we spoke to in the slides kicks in. And if there is a surgery process, that process goes through to... it's put it on our board. Thank you.
Mr. Masilela, is there anything you'd like to add, sir?
Chair, just short comments. First, thanks for the opportunity. Chair, I and an honorable members, I fully concur with what the commissioner and our acting DG have said on this matter. I think the two departments are quite serious to resolve these issues, and as the commissioner says, to find permanent and workable solutions. Chair, the one issue that I would like to raise with the committee is the issue of funded and unfunded mandate. Health is a concurrent function between national and provincial departments of health. And provinces are very sensitive to us as national imposing on them mandates that they may perceive as unfunded. Therefore, as we move forward, as the commissioner has indicated, we'll have to involve national pressure to ensure that adequate resources are provided for these functions that we are intending to take over as the health sector. It's a public health issue. From a public health perspective, we think it is in our best interest to look after everybody in the country. Section 27 of the Constitution says. It's also a humanitarian issue. But from a budget perspective, it's also a numbers issue. We've got to know what prison population are we talking about, what is the magnitude of the additional number of people that we have to look at, and therefore work with our coalition treasury so that we ensure that there's no conflict between ourselves and provinces, so that this is a funded mandate. And as the lastly, as the commissioner has pointed out, we will involve DCS in the technical committee, which consists of our acting DG and the 9 provincial heads of department. Thanks, Chair.
Chairperson Kokon, is there anything you'd like to add before we wrap up this section?
Thanks very much. I think one of the things that I was going to say, which is about this concurrent sanction, has been mentioned. I think this is one of the stumbling blocks as I'm listening. But looking at what's happening, I think I go along with the presentation that you made, Commissioner. Much as I still wanted to know which is the best option out of those options that you mentioned, which we can assist in. But I would think for this process to move, if you're saying that it's the Division of Health and Correctional Services coming together, probably it will never move because each one is going to say no. He or she is going to do it and you end up not doing anything. But it's something to say health must take lead on this thing. And those are the people that have to account as to what is going on. Or we say correctional service, but I would imagine that for me, it would be better to say health. It does not mean that health is going to be getting all the resources, human or whatever, but just to say this is where we are. And while we are doing that, and that audit that needs to be done, which I'm hoping that by end of May we'll be having that audit as to know what is going on. But the problem is now. What are we doing now while we are waiting for the audit? So that when the audit or when we are looking for that long-term solution, but the problems that are there now, because it's worrying when you talk about those mortalities, that the mortality is actually going up. And in fact, I would imagine that the fact that you get incarcerated, we need more psychiatrists than other people, because that's where some of those mortality. If I've got HIV and AIDS, just for an example, and I'm healthy, I'm eating 3 times a day, and then you start putting me in jail, I'm going to be depressed. And once I'm depressed, my white cell count is going to drop. And once it drops, it actually makes me die earlier than the other HIV person who's outside, who's not a problem. But now you need somebody who's going to counsel you and make you understand. But the other point that is very important is the one that was said by Jochen before he left. You know, we're saying on one side, these people have done something wrong, and they need to pay or understand that, to be punished for what they've done. But on the other side, you've got an obligation to look after them and make sure that they are comfortable. And when you give them comfort, you're making them to think that jail is better than outside. When you don't do anything, still there's going to be mortalities. So you've got to have that balance. But I would suggest that if we could make sure that there's one person who's going to answer, whether it's health or whatever, but somebody who's going to answer and say, where are we? And I would request with your permission, without having looked at our diaries of portfolio for Committee for Health, that in the subsequent meetings that are going to be happening, we'd like to be part of them so that we can assist wherever we can assist. Thank you very much. Thank you for inviting us.
Because we're good citizens in DCS, can we suggest that you schedule the next one and you invite us as visitors? I mean, it is a serious problem in our case. And I mean, if you are saying that health has a role to play, can we ask you to put this onto your own committee agenda at some point to look at the relationship between DCS and correctional services, but with the driver being the committee on health, and we will clearly come in and gladly come and participate in it. Then it becomes owned by all of us. Because I do think, Ms. Reiner, that the more we sit here, the more it's become clear that part of the problem of DCS anyway has been the silo mentality that it's had. That DCS thought the world starts and ends at DCS. And the integration, whether it was with education, whether it was with health, whether it was with public works, just didn't happen. And maybe it was because we were seen as a not so important entity for the reasons that you've raised. These people have committed a crime, throw them away and just leave them there forever. So nobody worried whether we were getting educated in there, whether we were getting ARVs in there, whether we were getting proper running toilets and taps in there. I think that has been part historically of our problem, but hopefully it will change. And when we become part of the mainstream, hopefully, then whatever happens outside must happen to us inside. When I say to us, I'm talking about our constituencies, Jenny, not you and I personally. But, thank you very much for attending. The more we spread the word, the lesser the burden becomes on correctional services, but more on Parliament as a whole, because it's our responsibility together. So thank you very much, Chairperson, and we will come when you next call us. So that concludes that part of the business. Before we wrap up, finally, Ms. Reiner, next week, 5th of May is our next interview. We go on a week's recess, but on the 5th of May, we are going to be seeing you again, together with the parole board, so that we can enact, not the parole boards, but I mean on the parole board matches, so that we get a sense of what's happening there. And whilst we're on that one, Ms. Schreiner, could you, in your preparations, come back and again we'll use this as a case study maybe. You know, a couple of months ago, and I don't want to open up a can of worms, or a year or two ago, we had this scenario of Mark Scott Crosley and Mr. Machabule. The one is out on parole, as I believe, the other one is not on parole. Are we aware of that one? That one is on parole and one is not on parole. The same case. The farmer asked the worker to throw somebody into the... because the journalists are here, they will... But there was a scenario of somebody being thrown into a lion's den. One of them is on parole, as I understand it. The other one is not on parole. The question is, why? You know, if you could just give us, so that we could use that as a case study in terms of how applicable are our policies to what is happening on the ground. So when you deal with, and of course you're going to deal with all the other issues, where are you in terms of appointing the chairs and the deputy chairs? But I'm saying this particular one, just being a case study for us. And then, of course, we are seeing the department very much in the same fashion. You're coming to talk to us about education in the facility. So we will invite the chair and his committee of education, higher education, I think, and basic education. So the chairs and the departments will be there listening to us, and we'll have a similar type of engagement. Okay. So members, as well as I'd ask, please let's not wait for the department to give us the input, which they're going to do. They will give us the slides prior to the time. But it helps when we are able to say, in my constituency, this is the real problem happening there. What are you guys doing about it? Just the theory, I'm beginning to think that it's just we must do it because we are Parliament. So people just come here and they give us a list of what is being done. They give us all the theory. And we can't relate it to what's happening in Westbury or Bosmont or Nuclear or El Dorado Park or wherever I happen to be. So members, you have 2 or 3 weeks to look at these things so that you could also engage meaningfully on them. We want to thank the department. We want to thank our visitors from the Department of Health as well as the Portfolio Committee of Health. And as always, we want to thank our friends from the media. Thank you very much. And also then to the members of the committee. We go on recess. It's the last one. We come back on the, as a committee, I mean, on the 5th of May, old assembly, unless it changes. and we're dealing with the feedback of the minister on the issues that she's supposed to have fed back to us, as well as DCS and its progress with parole boards, and also DCS and its relationship, and also its service provision in terms of education in our facilities. Thank you very much. The meeting is now adjourned.
Thank you. Thank you.